The lay aristocracy creates the feudal system, which slightly tempers the prevailing turbulent anarchy. Christian humility is preached by the clergy, but practiced only by the lower classes. Pagan pride is embodied in the duel, trial by battle, tournaments, and private revenge, all of which the church dislikes but cannot prevent. With great difficulty, beginning in the 11th century, the church succeeds in emancipating itself from the feudal aristocracy, and this emancipation is one of the causes of the emergence of Europe from the Dark Ages. The first great period of Catholic philosophy was dominated by St. Augustine and by Plato among the pagans. The second period culminates in St. Thomas Aquinas, for whom, and for his successors, Aristotle far outweighs Plato. The dualism of the City of God, however, survives in full force. The Church represents the City of God, and politically, philosophers stand for the interests of the Church. Philosophy was concerned to defend the faith, and invoked reason to enable it to argue with those who, like the Mohammedans, did not accept the validity of the Christian revelation. By this invocation of reason, the philosophers challenged criticism, not merely as theologians, but as inventors of systems designed to appeal to men of no matter what creed. In the long run, the appeal to reason was perhaps a mistake, but in the 13th century it seemed highly successful. The 13th century synthesis, which had an air of completeness and finality, was destroyed by a variety of causes. Perhaps the most important of these was the growth of a rich commercial class, first in Italy and then elsewhere. The feudal aristocracy, in the main, had been ignorant, stupid, and barbaric. The common people had sided with the church as superior to the nobles in intelligence, in morality, and in capacity to combat anarchy. But the new commercial class were as intelligent as the clergy, as well informed in mundane matters, more capable of coping with the nobles, and more acceptable to the urban lower classes as champions of civic liberty. Democratic tendencies came to the fore, and after helping the Pope to defeat the Emperor, set to work to emancipate economic life from ecclesiastical control. Another cause of the end of the Middle Ages was the rise of strong national monarchies in France, England, and Spain. Having suppressed internal anarchy and allied themselves with the rich merchants against the aristocracy, the kings, after the middle of the 15th century, were strong enough to fight the Pope in the national interest. The papacy, meanwhile, had lost the moral prestige which it had enjoyed, and on the whole deserved, in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. First, by subservience to France during the period when the popes lived at Avignon, then by the Great Schism, they had unintentionally persuaded the Western world that an unchecked papal autocracy was neither possible nor desirable. In the 15th century, their position as rulers of Christendom became subordinate, in practice, to their position as Italian princes, involved in the complex and unscrupulous game of Italian power politics. And so the Renaissance and the Reformation disrupted the medieval synthesis, which has not yet been succeeded by anything so tidy and so apparently complete. The growth and decay of this synthesis is the subject of Book Two. The mood of thoughtful men throughout the whole period was one of deep unhappiness in regard to the affairs of this world, only rendered endurable by the hope of a better world hereafter. This unhappiness was a reflection of what was happening throughout Western Europe. The 3rd century was a period of disaster, when the general level of well-being was sharply lowered. After a lull during the 4th century, the 5th brought the extinction of the Western Empire and the establishment of barbarians throughout its former territory. The cultivated urban rich, upon whom late Roman civilization depended, were largely reduced to the condition of destitute refugees. The remainder took to living on their rural estates. Fresh shocks continued until about AD 1000, without any sufficient breathing space to allow of recovery. The wars of Byzantines and Lombards destroyed most of what remained of the civilization of Italy. The Arabs conquered most of the territory of the Eastern Empire, established themselves in Africa and Spain, threatened France, and even, on one occasion, sacked Rome. The Danes and Normans caused havoc in France and England, in Sicily and southern Italy. Life throughout these centuries was precarious and full of hardship. Bad as it was in reality, gloomy superstitions made it even worse. It was thought that the great majority, even of Christians, would go to hell. At every moment, men felt themselves encompassed by evil spirits and exposed to the machinations of sorcerers and witches. No joy of life was possible, except in fortunate moments, to those who retained the thoughtlessness of children. The general misery heightened the intensity of religious feeling. The life of the good here below was a pilgrimage to the heavenly city. Nothing of value was possible in the sublunary world except the steadfast virtue that would lead, in the end, to eternal bliss. The Greeks, in their great days, had found joy and beauty in the everyday world. Empedocles, apostrophizing his fellow citizens, says, "Friends that inhabit the great town looking down on the yellow rock of Acragas, up by the citadel, busy in goodly works, harbour of honour for the stranger, men unskilled in meanness, all hail." In later times, until the Renaissance, men had no such simple happiness in the visible world, but turned their hopes to the unseen. Acragas is replaced in their love by Jerusalem the Golden. When earthly happiness at last returned, the intensity of longing for the other world grew gradually less. Men used the same words, but with a less profound sincerity. In the attempt to make the genesis and significance of Catholic philosophy intelligible, I have found it necessary to devote more space to general history than is demanded in connection with either ancient or modern philosophy. Catholic philosophy is essentially the philosophy of an institution, namely the Catholic Church. Modern philosophy, even when it is far from orthodox, is largely concerned with problems, especially in ethics and political theory, which are derived from Christian views of the moral law and from Catholic doctrines as to the relations of church and state. In Greco-Roman paganism, there is no such dual loyalty as the Christian, from the very beginning, has owed to God and Caesar, or in political terms, to church and state. The problems raised by this dual loyalty were, for the most part, worked out in practice before the philosophers supplied the necessary theory. In this process, there were two very distinct stages, one before the fall of the Western Empire and one after it. The practice of a long line of bishops, culminating in St. Ambrose, supplied the basis for St. Augustine's political philosophy. Then came the barbarian invasion, followed by a long time of confusion and increasing ignorance. Between Boethius and St. Anselm, a period of over five centuries, there is only one eminent philosopher, John the Scot, and he, as an Irishman, had largely escaped the various processes that were moulding the rest of the Western world. But this period, in spite of the absence of philosophers, was not one during which there was no intellectual development. Chaos raised urgent practical problems, which were dealt with by means of institutions and modes of thought that dominated scholastic philosophy and are, to a great extent, still important at the present day. These institutions and modes of thought were not introduced to the world by theorists, but by practical men in the stress of conflict. The moral reform of the Church in the 11th century, which was the immediate prelude to the scholastic philosophy, was a reaction against the increasing absorption of the Church into the feudal system. To understand the scholastics, we must understand Hildebrand, and to understand Hildebrand, we must know something of the evils against which he contended. Nor can we ignore the foundation of the Holy Roman Empire and its effect upon European thought. For these reasons, the reader will find in the following pages much ecclesiastical and political history of which the relevance to the development of philosophic thought may not be immediately evident. It is the more necessary to relate something of this history as the period concerned is obscure and is unfamiliar to many who are at home with both ancient and modern history. Few technical philosophers have had as much influence on philosophic thought as St. Ambrose, Charlemagne, and Hildebrand. To relate what is essential concerning these men and their times is therefore indispensable in any adequate treatment of our subject. Part 1. the Fathers. Chapter 1. The Religious Development of the Jews. The Christian religion, as it was handed over by the late Roman Empire to the barbarians, consisted of three elements. First, certain philosophical beliefs, derived mainly from Plato and the Neoplatonists, but also in part from the Stoics. Second, a conception of morals and history derived from the Jews. And thirdly, certain theories, more especially as to salvation, which were on the whole new in Christianity, though in part traceable to Orphism and to kindred cults of the Near East. The most important Jewish elements in Christianity appear to me to be the following. 1. A sacred history, beginning with the creation, leading to a consummation in the future, and justifying the ways of God to man. 2. The existence of a small section of mankind whom God specially loves. For Jews, this section was the chosen people. For Christians, the elect. 3. A new conception of righteousness. The virtue of almsgiving, for example, was taken over by Christianity from later Judaism. The importance attached to baptism might be derived from Orphism or from Oriental pagan mystery religions, but practical philanthropy as an element in the Christian conception of virtue seems to have come from the Jews. 4. The law. Christians kept part of the Hebrew law, for instance the Decalogue, while they rejected its ceremonial and ritual parts. But in practice, they attached to the creed much the same feelings that the Jews attached to the law. This involved the doctrine that correct belief is at least as important as virtuous action, a doctrine which is essentially Hellenic. What is Jewish in origin is the exclusiveness of the elect. 5. The Messiah. The Jews believed that the Messiah would bring them temporal prosperity and victory over their enemies here on earth. Moreover, he remained in the future. For Christians, the Messiah was the historical Jesus, who was also identified with the Logos of Greek philosophy, and it was not on earth but in heaven that the Messiah was to enable his followers to triumph over their enemies. 6. The Kingdom of Heaven. Otherworldliness is a conception which Jews and Christians, in a sense, share with later Platonism, but it takes with them a much more concrete form than with Greek philosophers. The Greek doctrine, which is to be found in much Christian philosophy, but not in popular Christianity, was that the sensible world, in space and time, is an illusion, and that by intellectual and moral discipline, a man can learn to live in the eternal world, which alone is real. The Jewish and Christian doctrine, on the other hand, conceived the other world as not metaphysically different from this world, but as in the future, when the virtuous would enjoy everlasting bliss and the wicked would suffer everlasting torment. This belief embodied revenge psychology and was intelligible to all and sundry, as the doctrines of Greek philosophers were not. To understand the origin of these beliefs, we must take account of certain facts in Jewish history, to which we will now turn our attention. The early history of the Israelites cannot be confirmed from any source outside the Old Testament, and it is impossible to know at what point it ceases to be purely legendary. David and Solomon may be accepted as kings who probably had a real existence, but at the earliest point at which we come to something certainly historical, there are already the two kingdoms of Israel and Judah. The first person mentioned in the Old Testament of whom there is an independent record is Ahab, king of Israel, who is spoken of in an Assyrian letter of 853 BC. The Assyrians finally conquered the northern kingdom in 722 BC and removed a great part of the population. After this time, the kingdom of Judah alone preserved the Israelite religion and tradition. The kingdom of Judah just survived the Assyrians, whose power came to an end with the capture of Nineveh by the Babylonians and Medes in 606 BC. But in 586 BC, Nebuchadrezzar captured Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and removed a large part of the population to Babylon. The Babylonian kingdom fell in 538 BC when Babylon was taken by Cyrus, king of the Medes and Persians. Cyrus, in 537 BC, issued an edict allowing the Jews to return to Palestine. Many of them did so, under the leadership of Nehemiah and Ezra. The temple was rebuilt, and Jewish orthodoxy began to be crystallized. In the period of the captivity, and for some time before and after this period, Jewish religion went through a very important development. Originally, there appears to have been not very much difference, from a religious point of view, between the Israelites and surrounding tribes. Yahweh was at first only a tribal god who favored the children of Israel, but it was not denied that there were other gods, and their worship was habitual. When the first commandment says, "Thou shalt have none other gods but me," it is saying something which was an innovation in the time immediately preceding the captivity. This is made evident by various texts in the earlier prophets. It was the prophets at this time who first taught that the worship of heathen gods was sin. To win the victory in the constant wars of that time, they proclaimed, the favor of Yahweh was essential, and Yahweh would withdraw his favor if other gods were also honored. Jeremiah and Ezekiel especially seem to have invented the idea that all religions except one are false, and that the Lord punishes idolatry. Some quotations will illustrate their teachings, and the prevalence of the heathen practices against which they protested. "Seest thou not what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven, Ishtar, and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods, that they may provoke me to anger." Footnote. Jeremiah chapter 7, verses 17 to 18. End of footnote. The Lord is angry about it. "And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart." Footnote. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 31. End of footnote. There is a very interesting passage in Jeremiah in which he denounces the Jews in Egypt for their idolatry. He himself had lived among them for a time. The prophet tells the Jewish refugees in Egypt that Yahweh will destroy them all because their wives have burnt incense to other gods. But they refuse to listen to him, saying, "We will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth, to burn incense unto the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto her, as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings, and our princes, in the cities of Judah, and in the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty of victuals, and were well, and saw no evil." But Jeremiah assures them that Yahweh noticed these idolatrous practices, and that misfortune has come because of them. "Behold, I have sworn by my great name, saith the Lord, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt. I will watch over them for evil, and not for good, and all the men of Judah that are in the land of Egypt shall be consumed by the sword and by the famine, until there be an end of them." Footnote. Jeremiah chapter 44, verse 11 to end. End of footnote. Ezekiel is equally shocked by the idolatrous practices of the Jews. The Lord, in a vision, shows him women at the north gate of the temple, weeping for Tammuz, a Babylonian deity. Then he shows him greater abominations, 25 men at the door of the temple, worshipping the sun. The Lord declares, "Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them." Footnote. Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 11 to end. End of footnote. The idea that all religions but one are wicked, and that the Lord punishes idolatry, was apparently invented by these prophets. The prophets, on the whole, were fiercely nationalistic, and looked forward to the day when the Lord would utterly destroy the Gentiles. The captivity was taken to justify the denunciations of the prophets. If Yahweh was all-powerful and the Jews were his chosen people, their sufferings could only be explained by their wickedness. The psychology is that of paternal correction. The Jews are to be purified by punishment. Under the influence of this belief, they developed, in exile, an orthodoxy much more rigid and much more nationally exclusive than that which had prevailed while they were independent. The Jews who remained behind and were not transplanted to Babylon did not undergo this development to anything like the same extent. When Ezra and Nehemiah came back to Jerusalem after the captivity, they were shocked to find that mixed marriages had been common, and they dissolved all such marriages. Footnote: Ezra, chapters 9 and 10, verse 5. End of footnote. The Jews were distinguished from the other nations of antiquity by their stubborn national pride. All the others, when conquered, acquiesced inwardly as well as outwardly. The Jews alone retained the belief in their own preeminence and the conviction that their misfortunes were due to God's anger because they had failed to preserve the purity of their faith and ritual. The historical books of the Old Testament, which were mostly compiled after the captivity, give a misleading impression, since they suggest that the idolatrous practices against which the prophets protested were a falling off from earlier strictness, whereas in fact the earlier strictness had never existed. The prophets were innovators to a much greater extent than appears in the Bible when read unhistorically. Some things which were afterwards characteristic of Jewish religion were developed, though in part from previously existing sources, during the captivity. Owing to the destruction of the temple, where alone sacrifices could be offered, the Jewish ritual perforce became non-sacrificial. Synagogues began at this time, with readings from such portions of the scriptures as already existed. The importance of the Sabbath was first emphasized at this time, and so was circumcision as the mark of the Jew. As we have already seen, it was only during the exile that marriage with Gentiles came to be forbidden. There was a growth of every form of exclusiveness. I am the Lord your God, which have separated you from other people. Footnote. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 24. End of footnote. Ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Footnote. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2. End of footnote. The law is a product of this period. It was one of the chief forces in preserving national unity. What we have as the book of Isaiah is the work of two different prophets, one before the exile and one after. The second of these, who is called by biblical students Deutero-Isaiah, is the most remarkable of the prophets. He is the first who reports the Lord as saying, "There is no God but I." He believes in the resurrection of the body, perhaps as a result of Persian influence. His prophecies of the Messiah were later the chief Old Testament texts used to show that the prophets foresaw the coming of Christ. In Christian arguments with both pagans and Jews, these texts from Deutero-Isaiah played a very important part, and for this reason I shall quote the most important of them. All nations are to be converted in the end. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Footnote. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. End of footnote. As to this text, there was a controversy between Jews and Christians. The Jews said that the correct translation is, "A young woman shall conceive," but the Christians thought the Jews were lying. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Footnote. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 and 6. End of footnote. The most apparently prophetic of these passages is the 53rd chapter, which contains the familiar texts. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. The inclusion of the Gentiles in the ultimate salvation is explicit. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. Footnote, Isaiah chapter 60, verse 3. End of footnote. After Ezra and Nehemiah, the Jews for a while disappear from history. The Jewish state survived as a theocracy, but its territory was very small, only the region of 10 to 15 miles around Jerusalem, according to E. Bevan. After Alexander, it became a disputed territory between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. This, however, seldom involved fighting in actual Jewish territory and left the Jews for a long time to the free exercise of their religion. Their moral maxims at this time are set forth in Ecclesiasticus, probably written about 200 BC. Until recently, this book was only known in a Greek version. This is the reason for its being banished to the Apocrypha. But a Hebrew manuscript has lately been discovered, in some respects different from the Greek text translated in our version of the Apocrypha. The morality taught is very mundane. Reputation among neighbors is highly prized. Honesty is the best policy because it is useful to have Yahweh on your side. Almsgiving is recommended. The only sign of Greek influence is in the praise of medicine. Slaves must not be treated too kindly. Fodder, a wand, and burdens are for the ass, and bread, correction, and work for a servant. Set him to work as is fit for him. If he be not obedient, put on more heavy fetters. At the same time, remember that you have paid a price for him, and that if he runs away, you will lose your money. This sets a limit to profitable severity. Daughters are a great source of anxiety. Apparently in his day they were much addicted to immorality. He has a low opinion of women. From garments cometh a moth, and from women wickedness. It is a mistake to be cheerful with your children. The right course is to bow down their neck from their youth. Altogether, like the elder Cato, he represents the morality of the virtuous businessman in a very unattractive light. This tranquil existence of comfortable self-righteousness was rudely interrupted by the Seleucid king Antiochus IV, who was determined to Hellenize all his dominions. In 175 BC, he established a gymnasium in Jerusalem and taught young men to wear Greek hats and practice athletics. In this, he was helped by a Hellenizing Jew named Jason, whom he made high priest. The priestly aristocracy had become lax and had felt the attraction of Greek civilization, but they were vehemently opposed by a party called the Hasidim, meaning holy, who were strong among the rural population. Footnote. From them probably developed the sect of the Essenes, whose doctrines seem to have influenced primitive Christianity. The Pharisees also descended from them. End of footnote. When, in 170 BC, Antiochus became involved in war with Egypt, the Jews rebelled. Thereupon, Antiochus took the holy vessels from the temple and placed in it the image of the god. He identified Yahweh with Zeus, following a practice which had been successful everywhere else. Footnote. Some Alexandrian Jews did not object to this identification. End of footnote. He resolved to extirpate the Jewish religion and to stop circumcision and the observance of the laws relating to food. To all this, Jerusalem submitted, but outside Jerusalem, the Jews resisted with the utmost stubbornness. The history of this period is told in the first book of Maccabees. The first chapter tells how Antiochus decreed that all the inhabitants of his kingdom should be one people and abandon their separate laws. All the heathen obeyed, and many of the Israelites, although the king commanded that they should profane the Sabbath, sacrifice swine's flesh, and leave their children uncircumcised. All who disobeyed were to suffer death. Many nevertheless resisted. They put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised, and they hanged the infants about their necks, and rifled their houses, and slew them that had circumcised them. Howbeit many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat any unclean thing. Wherefore they chose rather to die, that they might not be defiled with meats, and that they might not profane the holy covenant. So then they died. Footnote. 1 Maccabees, chapter 1, verses 60 to 63. End of footnote. It was at this time that the doctrine of immortality came to be widely believed among the Jews. It had been thought that virtue would be rewarded here on earth, but persecution which fell upon the most virtuous made it evident that this was not the case. In order to safeguard divine justice, therefore, it was necessary to believe in rewards and punishments hereafter. This doctrine was not universally accepted among the Jews. In the time of Christ, the Sadducees still rejected it. But by that time they were a small party, and in later times all Jews believed in immortality. The revolt against Antiochus was led by Judas Maccabeus, an able military commander who first recaptured Jerusalem, 164 BC, and then embarked upon aggression. Sometimes he killed all the males, sometimes he circumcised them by force. His brother Jonathan was made high priest, was allowed to occupy Jerusalem with a garrison, and conquered part of Samaria, acquiring Joppa and Acre. He negotiated with Rome and was successful in securing complete autonomy. His family were high priests until Herod, and are known as the Hasmonean dynasts. In enduring and resisting persecution, the Jews of this time showed immense heroism, although in defense of things that do not strike us as important, such as circumcision and the wickedness of eating pork. The time of the persecution by Antiochus IV was crucial in Jewish history. The Jews of the dispersion were at this time becoming more and more Hellenized. The Jews of Judea were few, and even among them the rich and powerful were inclined to acquiesce in Greek innovations. But for the heroic resistance of the Hasidim, the Jewish religion might easily have died out. If this had happened, neither Christianity nor Islam could have existed in anything like the form they actually took. Townsend, in his introduction to the translation of the fourth book of Maccabees, says, "It has been finally said that if Judaism as a religion had perished under Antiochus, the seedbed of Christianity would have been lacking, and thus the blood of the Maccabean martyrs who saved Judaism ultimately became the seed of the church. Therefore, as not only Christendom but also Islam derive their monotheism from a Jewish source, it may well be that the world today owes the very existence of monotheism, both in the East and in the West, to the Maccabees." The Maccabees themselves, however, were not admired by later Jews, because their family as high priests adopted, after their successes, a worldly and temporizing policy. Admiration was for the martyrs. The fourth book of Maccabees, written probably in Alexandria about the time of Christ, illustrates this as well as some other interesting points. In spite of its title, it nowhere mentions the Maccabees, but relates the amazing fortitude, first of an old man, and then of seven young brothers, all of whom were first tortured and then burnt by Antiochus, while their mother, who was present, exhorted them to stand firm. The king at first tried to win them by friendliness, telling them that if they would only consent to eat pork, he would take them into his favor and secure successful careers for them. When they refused, he showed them the instruments of torture, but they remained unshakable, telling him that he would suffer eternal torment after death, while they would inherit everlasting bliss. One by one, in each other's presence, and in that of their mother, they were first exhorted to eat pork, then, when they refused, tortured and killed. At the end, the king turned round to his soldiers and told them he hoped they would profit by such an example of courage. The account is, of course, embellished by legend, but it is historically true that the persecution was severe and was endured heroically. Also, that the main points at issue were circumcision and eating pork. This book is interesting in another respect. Although the writer is obviously an Orthodox Jew, he uses the language of the Stoic philosophy and is concerned to prove that the Jews live most completely in accordance with its precepts. The book opens with the sentence, "Philosophical in the highest degree is the question I propose to discuss, namely, whether the inspired reason is supreme ruler over the passions. And to the philosophy of it, I would seriously entreat your earnest attention." Alexandrian Jews were willing in philosophy to learn from the Greeks, but they adhered with extraordinary tenacity to the law, especially circumcision, observance of the Sabbath, and abstinence from pork and other unclean meats. From the time of Nehemiah till after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, the importance that they attached to the law steadily increased. They no longer tolerated prophets who had anything new to say. Those among them who felt impelled to write in the style of the prophets pretended that they had discovered an old book by Daniel or Solomon or some other ancient of impeccable respectability. Their ritual peculiarities held them together as a nation, but emphasis on the law gradually destroyed originality and made them intensely conservative. This rigidity makes the revolt of St. Paul against the domination of the law very remarkable. The New Testament, however, is not such a completely new beginning as it is apt to seem to those who know nothing of Jewish literature in the times just before the birth of Christ. Prophetic fervor was by no means dead, though it had to adopt the devices of pseudonymity in order to obtain a hearing. Of the greatest interest in this respect is the Book of Enoch, a composite work due to various authors, the earliest being slightly before the time of the Maccabees and the latest about 64 BC. Most of it professes to relate apocalyptic visions of the patriarch Enoch. It is very important for the side of Judaism which turned to Christianity. The New Testament writers are familiar with it. St. Jude considers it to be actually by Enoch. Early Christian fathers, for instance, Clement of Alexandria and Tertullian, treated it as canonical, but Jerome and Augustine rejected it. It fell, consequently, into oblivion, and was lost until, early in the 19th century, three manuscripts of it, in Ethiopic, were found in Abyssinia. Since then, manuscripts of parts of it have been found in Greek and Latin versions. It appears to have been originally written partly in Hebrew, partly in Aramaic. Its authors were members of the Hasidim, and their successors the Pharisees. It denounces kings and princes, meaning the Hasmonean dynasty and the Sadducees. It influenced New Testament doctrine, particularly as regards the Messiah, Sheol, hell, and demonology. The book consists mainly of parables, which are more cosmic than those of the New Testament. There are visions of heaven and hell, of the last judgment, and so on. One is reminded of the first two books of Paradise Lost, where the literary quality is good, and of Blake's prophetic books, where it is inferior. There is an expansion of Genesis chapter 6, verses 2 to 4, which is curious and Promethean. The angels taught men metallurgy and were punished for revealing eternal secrets. They were also cannibals. The angels that had sinned became pagan gods, and their women became sirens. But at the last, they were punished with everlasting torments. There are descriptions of heaven and hell which have considerable literary merit. The last judgment is performed by the Son of Man who hath righteousness and who sits on the throne of his glory. Some of the Gentiles at the last will repent and be forgiven, but most Gentiles and all Hellenizing Jews will suffer eternal damnation, for the righteous will pray for vengeance and their prayer will be granted. There is a section on astronomy where we learn that the sun and moon have chariots driven by the wind, that the year consists of 364 days, that human sin causes the heavenly bodies to depart from their courses, and that only the virtuous can know astronomy. Falling stars are falling angels and are punished by the seven archangels. Next comes sacred history. Up to the Maccabees, this pursues the course known from the Bible in its earlier portions, and from history in the later parts. Then the author goes on into the future. The New Jerusalem, the conversion of the remnant of the Gentiles, the resurrection of the righteous, and the Messiah. There is a great deal about the punishment of sinners and the reward of the righteous, who never display an attitude of Christian forgiveness toward sinners. What will ye do, ye sinners, and whither will ye flee on that day of judgment, when ye hear the voice of the prayer of the righteous? Sin has not been sent upon the earth, but man of himself has created it. Sins are recorded in heaven. Ye sinners shall be cursed for ever, and ye shall have no peace. Sinners may be happy all their lives, and even in dying, but their souls descend into Sheol, where they shall suffer darkness and chains and a burning flame. But as for the righteous, I and my son will be united with them forever. The last words of the book are, "To the faithful he will give faithfulness in the habitation of upright paths, and they shall see those who were born in darkness led into darkness, while the righteous shall be resplendent, and the sinners shall cry aloud and see them resplendent, and they indeed will go where days and seasons are prescribed for them." Jews, like Christians, thought much about sin, but few of them thought of themselves as sinners. This was, in the main, a Christian innovation, introduced by the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, and taught as a virtue in Christ's denunciations of the scribes and Pharisees. The Christians endeavored to practice Christian humility. The Jews in general did not. There are, however, important exceptions among Orthodox Jews just before the time of Christ. Take, for instance, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, written between 109 and 107 BC by a Pharisee who admired John Hyrcanus, a high priest of the Hasmonean dynasty. This book, in the form in which we have it, contains Christian interpolations, but these are all concerned with dogma. When they are excised, the ethical teaching remains closely similar to that of the Gospels. As the Reverend Dr. R. H. Childs says, "The Sermon on the Mount reflects in several instances the spirit and even reproduces the very phrases of our text. Many passages in the Gospel exhibit traces of the same, and St. Paul seems to have used the book as a vade mecum." We find in this book such precepts as the following: "Love ye one another from the heart. And if a man sin against thee, speak peaceably to him, and in thy soul hold not guile. And if he repent and confess, forgive him. But if he deny it, do not get into a passion with him, lest, catching the poison from thee, he take to swearing, and so then sin doubly. And if he be shameless and persist in wrongdoing, even so forgive him from the heart, and leave to God the avenging." Dr. Childs is of the opinion that Christ must have been acquainted with this passage. Again we find, "Love the Lord and your neighbor. Love the Lord through all your life and one another with a true heart. I loved the Lord, likewise also every man with all my heart." These are to be compared with Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 to 39. There is a reprobation of all hatred in the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. For instance, "Anger is blindness, and does not suffer one to see the face of any man with truth. Hatred, therefore, is evil, for it constantly mateth with lying." The author of this book, as might be expected, holds that not only the Jews, but all the Gentiles will be saved. Christians have learnt from the Gospels to think ill of Pharisees, yet the author of this book was a Pharisee, and he taught, as we have seen, those very ethical maxims which we think of as most distinctive of Christ's preaching. The explanation, however, is not difficult. In the first place, he must have been, even in his own day, an exceptional Pharisee. The more usual doctrine was, no doubt, that of the Book of Enoch. In the second place, we know that all movements tend to ossify. Who could infer the principles of Jefferson from those of the D.A.R.? In the third place, we know, as regards the Pharisees in particular, that their devotion to the law, as the absolute and final truth, soon put an end to all fresh and living thought and feeling among them. As Dr. Charles says, "When Pharisaism, breaking with the ancient ideals of its party, committed itself to political interests and movements, and concurrently therewith surrendered itself more and more wholly to the study of the letter of the law, it soon ceased to offer scope for the development of such a lofty system of ethics as the Testaments of the Patriarchs attest. And so the true successors of the early Hasids and their teaching quitted Judaism and found their natural home in the bosom of primitive Christianity." After a period of rule by the high priests, Mark Antony made his friend Herod king of the Jews. Herod was a gay adventurer, often on the verge of bankruptcy, accustomed to Roman society and very far removed from Jewish piety. His wife was of the family of the high priests, but he was an Idumean, which alone would suffice to make him an object of suspicion to the Jews. He was a skilful time-server, and deserted Antony promptly when it became evident that Octavius was going to be victorious. However, he made strenuous attempts to reconcile the Jews to his rule. He rebuilt the temple, though in a Hellenistic style, with rows of Corinthian pillars. But he placed over the main gate a large golden eagle, thereby infringing the second commandment. When it was rumoured that he was dying, the Pharisees pulled down the eagle, but he in revenge caused a number of them to be put to death. He died in 4 BC, and soon after his death the Romans abolished the kingship, putting Judea under a procurator. Pontius Pilate, who became procurator in AD 26, was tactless and was soon retired. In AD 66, the Jews, led by the party of the Zealots, rebelled against Rome. They were defeated, and Jerusalem was captured in AD 70. The temple was destroyed, and few Jews were left in Judea. The Jews of the dispersion had become important centuries before this time. The Jews had been originally an almost wholly agricultural people, but they learnt trading from the Babylonians during the captivity. Many of them remained in Babylon after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and among these some were very rich. After the foundation of Alexandria, great numbers of Jews settled in that city. They had a special quarter assigned to them, not as a ghetto, but to keep them from danger of pollution by contact with Gentiles. The Alexandrian Jews became much more Hellenized than those of Judea and forgot Hebrew. For this reason, it became necessary to translate the Old Testament into Greek. The result was the Septuagint. The Pentateuch was translated in the middle of the 3rd century BC, the other parts somewhat later. Legends arose about the Septuagint, so called because it was the work of 70 translators. It was said that each of the 70 translated the whole independently, and that when the versions were compared, they were found to be identical down to the smallest detail, having all been divinely inspired. Nevertheless, later scholarship showed that the Septuagint was gravely defective. The Jews, after the rise of Christianity, made little use of it, but reverted to reading the Old Testament in Hebrew. The early Christians, on the contrary, few of whom knew Hebrew, depended upon the Septuagint, or upon translations from it into Latin. A better text was produced by the labours of Origen in the 3rd century, but those who only knew Latin had very defective versions until Jerome in the 5th century produced the Vulgate. This was at first received with much criticism, because he had been helped by Jews in establishing the text, and many Christians thought that Jews had deliberately falsified the prophets in order that they should not seem to foretell Christ. Gradually, however, the work of St. Jerome was accepted, and it remains to this day authoritative in the Catholic Church. The philosopher Philo, who was a contemporary of Christ, is the best illustration of Greek influence on the Jews in the sphere of thought. While orthodox in religion, Philo is in philosophy primarily a Platonist. Other important influences are those of the Stoics and Neopythagoreans. While his influence among the Jews ceased after the fall of Jerusalem, the Christian fathers found that he has shown the way to reconcile Greek philosophy with acceptance of the Hebrew scriptures. In every important city of antiquity, there came to be considerable colonies of Jews, who shared with the representatives of other Eastern religions an influence upon those who were not content either with skepticism or with the official religions of Greece and Rome. Many converts were made to Judaism, not only in the empire, but also in South Russia. It was probably to Jewish and semi-Jewish circles that Christianity first appealed. Orthodox Judaism, however, became more orthodox and more narrow after the fall of Jerusalem, just as it had done after the earlier fall due to Nebuchadrezzar. After the 1st century, Christianity also crystallized, and the relations of Judaism and Christianity were wholly hostile and external. As we shall see, Christianity powerfully stimulated antisemitism. Throughout the Middle Ages, Jews had no part in the culture of Christian countries, and were too severely persecuted to be able to make contributions to civilization beyond supplying capital for the building of cathedrals and such enterprises. It was only among the Mohammedans at that period that Jews were treated humanely, and were able to pursue philosophy and enlightened speculation. Throughout the Middle Ages, the Mohammedans were more civilized and more humane than the Christians. Christians persecuted Jews, especially at times of religious excitement. The Crusades were associated with appalling pogroms. In Mohammedan countries, on the contrary, Jews were not in any way ill-treated. Especially in Moorish Spain, they contributed to learning. Maimonides, 1135 to 1204, who was born at Cordova, is regarded by some as the source of much of Spinoza's philosophy. When the Christians reconquered Spain, it was largely the Jews who transmitted to them the learning of the Moors. Learned Jews who knew Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic, and were acquainted with the philosophy of Aristotle, transmitted their knowledge to less learned schoolmen. They transmitted also less desirable things, such as alchemy and astrology. After the Middle Ages, the Jews still contributed largely to civilization as individuals, but no longer as a race. Chapter 2. Christianity during the first four centuries. Christianity at first was preached by Jews to Jews, as Reformed Judaism. St. James, and to a lesser extent St. Peter, wished it to remain no more than this, and they might have prevailed but for St. Paul, who was determined to admit Gentiles without demanding circumcision or submission to the Mosaic law. The contention between the two factions is related in the Acts of the Apostles from a Pauline point of view. The communities of Christians that St. Paul established in many places were no doubt composed partly of converts from among the Jews, partly of Gentiles seeking a new religion. The certainties of Judaism made it attractive in that age of dissolving faiths. But circumcision was an obstacle to the conversion of men. The ritual laws in regard to food were also inconvenient. These two obstacles, even if there had been no others, would have made it almost impossible for the Hebrew religion to become universal. Christianity, owing to St. Paul, retained what was attractive in the doctrines of the Jews without the features that Gentiles found hardest to assimilate. The view that the Jews were the chosen people remained, however, obnoxious to Greek pride. This view was radically rejected by the Gnostics. They, or at least some of them, held that the sensible world had been created by an inferior deity named Ialdabaoth, the rebellious son of Sophia, heavenly wisdom. He, they said, is the Yahweh of the Old Testament, while the serpent, so far from being wicked, was engaged in warning Eve against his deceptions. For a long time, the supreme deity allowed Ialdabaoth free play. At last, he sent his son to inhabit temporarily the body of the man Jesus and to liberate the world from the false teaching of Moses. Those who held this view combined it, as a rule, with a Platonic philosophy. Plotinus, as we saw, found some difficulty in refuting it. Gnosticism afforded a halfway house between philosophic paganism and Christianity, for
the day and the hour and the minute.
The same was true later of Manichaeism, through which St. Augustine came to the Catholic faith. Manichaeism combined Christian and Zoroastrian elements, teaching that evil is a positive principle, embodied in matter, while the good principle is embodied in spirit. It condemned meat-eating and all sex, even in marriage. Such intermediate doctrines helped much in the gradual conversion of cultivated men of Greek speech. But the New Testament warns true believers against them. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, gnosis, falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. Footnote. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 20-21. End of footnote. Gnostics and Manichaeans continued to flourish until the government became Christian. After that time, they were led to conceal their beliefs, but they still had a subterranean influence. One of the doctrines of a certain sect of Gnostics was adopted by Muhammad. They taught that Jesus was a mere man, and that the Son of God descended upon him at the baptism and abandoned him at the time of the Passion. In support of this view, they appealed to the text, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Footnote. Mark chapter 25, verse 34. End of footnote. A text which, it must be confessed, Christians have always found difficult. The Gnostics considered it unworthy of the Son of God to be born, to be an infant, and above all to die on the cross. They said that these things had befallen the man Jesus, but not the divine Son of God. Muhammad, who recognized Jesus as a prophet, though not as divine, had a strong class feeling that prophets ought not to come to a bad end. He therefore adopted the view of the Docetics, a Gnostic sect, according to which it was a mere phantom that hung upon the cross, upon which, impotently and ignorantly, Jews and Romans wreaked their ineffectual vengeance. In this way, something of Gnosticism passed over into the Orthodox doctrine of Islam. The attitude of Christians to contemporary Jews early became hostile. The received view was that God had spoken to the patriarchs and prophets, who were holy men, and had foretold the coming of Christ. But when Christ came, the Jews failed to recognize him and were thenceforth to be accounted wicked. Moreover, Christ had abrogated the Mosaic law, substituting the two commandments to love God and our neighbor. This also the Jews perversely failed to recognize. As soon as the state became Christian, anti-Semitism in its medieval form began nominally as a manifestation of Christian zeal. How far the economic motives by which it was inflamed in later times operated in the Christian empire, it seems impossible to ascertain. In proportion as Christianity became Hellenized, it became theological. Jewish theology was always simple. Yahweh developed from a tribal deity into the sole omnipotent God who created heaven and earth. Divine justice, when it was seen not to confer earthly prosperity upon the virtuous, was transferred to heaven, which entailed belief in immortality. But throughout its evolution, the Jewish creed involved nothing complicated and metaphysical. It had no mysteries, and every Jew could understand it. This Jewish simplicity, on the whole, still characterizes the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but has already disappeared in St. John, where Christ is identified with the Platonic Stoic Logos. It is less Christ the man than Christ the theological figure that interests the fourth evangelist. This is still more true of the Fathers. You will find in their writings many more allusions to St. John than to the other three Gospels put together. The Pauline epistles also contain much theology, especially as regards salvation. At the same time, they show a considerable acquaintance with Greek culture, a quotation from Menander, an allusion to Epimenides the Cretan, said that all Cretans are liars, and so on. Nevertheless, St. Paul says, "Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit." Footnote. Or rather, the author of an epistle attributed to St. Paul, Colossians chapter 2, verse 8, end of footnote. The synthesis of Greek philosophy and Hebrew scriptures remained more or less haphazard and fragmentary until the time of Origen, AD 185 to 254. Origen, like Philo, lived in Alexandria, which, owing to commerce and the university, was, from its foundation to its fall, the chief center of learned syncretism. Like his contemporary Plotinus, he was a pupil of Ammonius Saccas, whom many regard as the founder of Neoplatonism. His doctrines, as set forth in his work De Principiis, have much affinity to those of Plotinus, more, in fact, than is compatible with orthodoxy. There is, Origen says, nothing wholly incorporeal except God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The stars are living, rational beings, to whom God has given souls that were already in existence. The sun, he thinks, can sin. The souls of men, as Plato taught, come to them at birth from elsewhere, having existed ever since the creation. Nous and soul are distinguished more or less as in Plotinus. When nous falls away, it becomes soul. Soul, when virtuous, becomes nous. Ultimately, all spirits will become wholly submissive to Christ, and will then be bodiless. Even the devil will be saved at the last. Origen, in spite of being recognized as one of the fathers, was in later times condemned as having maintained four heresies. 1. The pre-existence of souls, as taught by Plato. 2. That the human nature of Christ, and not only his divine nature, existed before the incarnation. 3. That at the resurrection, our bodies shall be transformed into absolutely ethereal bodies. 4. That all men, and even devils, shall be saved at the last. St. Jerome, who had expressed a somewhat unguarded admiration of Origen for his work in establishing the text of the Old Testament, found it prudent, subsequently, to expend much time and vehemence in repudiating his theological errors. Origen's aberrations were not only theological. In his youth, he was guilty of an irreparable error through a too literal interpretation of the text, "There be eunuchs, which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake." Footnote, Matthew chapter 19, verse 12. End of footnote. This method of escaping the temptations of the flesh, which Origen rashly adopted, has been condemned by the Church. Moreover, it made him ineligible for holy orders, although some ecclesiastics seem to have thought otherwise, thereby giving rise to unedifying controversies. Origen's longest work is a book entitled Against Celsus. Celsus was the author of a book, now lost, against Christianity, and Origen set to work to answer him point by point. Celsus begins by objecting to Christians because they belong to illegal associations. This Origen does not deny, but claims to be a virtue, like tyrannicide. He then comes to what is no doubt the real basis for the dislike of Christianity. Christianity, says Celsus, comes from the Jews, who are barbarians. And only Greeks can extract sense out of the teachings of barbarians. Origen replies that anyone coming from Greek philosophy to the Gospels would conclude that they are true, and supply a demonstration satisfying to the Greek intellect. But further, the Gospel has a demonstration of its own, more divine than any established by Grecian dialectics. And this diviner method is called by the Apostle the manifestation of the Spirit and of power. Of the Spirit, on account of the prophecies, which are sufficient to produce faith in any one who reads them, especially in those things which relate to Christ, and of power, because of the signs and wonders which we must believe to have been performed, both on many other grounds, and on this, that traces of them are still preserved among those who regulate their lives by the precepts of the Gospel. This passage is interesting, as showing already the twofold argument for belief which is characteristic of Christian philosophy. On the one hand, pure reason, rightly exercised, suffices to establish the essentials of the Christian faith, more especially God, immortality, and free will. But on the other hand, the Scriptures prove not only these bare essentials, but much more. And the divine inspiration of the Scriptures is proved by the fact that the prophets foretold the coming of the Messiah, by the miracles, and by the beneficent effects of belief on the lives of the faithful. Some of these arguments are now considered out of date, but the last of them was still employed by William James. All of them, until the Renaissance, were accepted by every Christian philosopher. Some of Origen's arguments are curious. He says that magicians invoke the God of Abraham, often without knowing who he is. But apparently this invocation is specially potent. Names are essential in magic. It is not indifferent whether God is called by his Jewish, Egyptian, Babylonian, Greek, or Brahman name. Magic formulae lose their efficacy when translated. One is led to suppose that the magicians of the time used formulae from all known religions. But if Origen is right, those derived from Hebrew sources were the most effective. The argument is the more curious as he points out that Moses forbade sorcery. Christians, we are told, should not take part in the government of the state, but only of the divine nation, that is, the Church. This doctrine, of course, was somewhat modified after the time of Constantine, but something of it survived. It is implicit in St. Augustine's City of God. It led churchmen at the time of the fall of the Western Empire to look on passively at secular disasters. While they exercised their very great talents in church discipline, theological controversy, and the spread of monasticism. Some trace of it still exists. Most people regard politics as worldly and unworthy of any really holy man. Church government developed slowly during the first three centuries and rapidly after the conversion of Constantine. Bishops were popularly elected. Gradually, they acquired considerable power over Christians in their own diocese, but before Constantine, there was hardly any form of central government over the whole church. The power of bishops in great cities was enhanced by the practice of almsgiving. The offerings of the faithful were administered by the bishop, who could give or withhold charity to the poor. There came thus to be a mob of the destitute, ready to do the bishop's will. When the state became Christian, the bishops were given judicial and administrative functions. There came also to be a central government, at least in matters of doctrine. Constantine was annoyed by the quarrel between Catholics and Arians. Having thrown in his lot with the Christians, he wanted them to be a united party. For the purpose of healing dissensions, he caused the convening of the Ecumenical Council of Nicaea, which drew up the Nicene Creed. Footnote: not exactly in its present form, which was decided upon in 362. End of footnote. And, so far as the Arian controversy was concerned, determined for all time the standard of orthodoxy. Other later controversies were similarly decided by ecumenical councils until the division between East and West and the Eastern refusal to admit the authority of the Pope made them impossible. The Pope, though officially the most important individual in the Church, had no authority over the Church as a whole until a much later period. The gradual growth of the papal power is a very interesting subject, which I shall deal with in later chapters. The growth of Christianity before Constantine, as well as the motives of his conversion, have been variously explained by various authors. Gibbon assigns five causes. 1. The inflexible, and if we may use the expression, the intolerant zeal of the Christians, derived, it is true, from the Jewish religion, but purified from the narrow and unsocial spirit which, instead of inviting, had deterred the Gentiles from embracing the law of Moses. 2. The doctrine of a future life, improved by every additional circumstance which could give weight and efficacy to that important truth. 3. The miraculous powers ascribed to the primitive church. 4. The pure and austere morals of the Christians. 5. The union and discipline of the Christian Republic, which gradually formed an independent and increasing state in the heart of the Roman Empire. Broadly speaking, this analysis may be accepted, but with some comments. The first cause, the inflexibility and intolerance derived from the Jews, may be wholly accepted. We have seen in our own day the advantages of intolerance in propaganda. The Christians, for the most part, believed that they alone would go to heaven, and that the most awful punishments would in the next world fall upon the heathen. The other religions which competed for favor during the third century had not this threatening character. The worshippers of the Great Mother, for example, while they had a ceremony, the Torah Bolium, which was analogous to baptism, did not teach that those who omitted it would go to hell. It may be remarked, incidentally, that the Torah Bolium was expensive. A bull had to be killed, and its blood allowed to trickle over the convert. A rite of this sort is aristocratic, and cannot be the basis of a religion which is to embrace the great bulk of the population, rich and poor, free and slave. In such respects, Christianity had an advantage over all its rivals. As regards the doctrine of a future life, in the West it was first taught by the Orphics, and thence adopted by Greek philosophers. The Hebrew prophets, some of them, taught the resurrection of the body, but it seems to have been from the Greeks that the Jews learnt to believe in the resurrection of the spirit. The doctrine of immortality in Greece had a popular form in Orphism and a learned form in Platonism. The latter, being based upon difficult arguments, could not become widely popular. The Orphic form, however, probably had a great influence on the general opinions of later antiquity, not only among pagans, but also among Jews and Christians. Elements of mystery religions, both Orphic and Asiatic, enter largely into Christian theology. In all of them, the central myth is that of the dying God who rises again. I think, therefore, that the doctrine of immortality must have had less to do with the spread of Christianity than Gibbon thought. Miracles certainly played a very large part in Christian propaganda, But miracles in later antiquity were very common, and were not the prerogative of any one religion. It is not altogether easy to see why, in this competition, the Christian miracles came to be more widely believed than those of other sects. I think Gibbon omits one very important matter, namely the possession of a sacred book. The miracles to which Christians appealed had begun in a remote antiquity, among a nation which the ancients felt to be mysterious. There was a consistent history from the creation onwards, according to which Providence had always worked wonders, first for the Jews, then for the Christians. To a modern historical student, it is obvious that the early history of the Israelites is in the main legendary, but not so to the ancients. They believed in the Homeric account of the siege of Troy, in Romulus and Remus, and so on. Why, asks Origen, should you accept these traditions and reject those of the Jews? To this argument, there was no logical answer. It was therefore natural to accept Old Testament miracles, and when they had been admitted, those of more recent date became credible, especially in view of the Christian interpretation of the prophets. The morals of the Christians, before Constantine, were undoubtedly very superior to those of average pagans. The Christians were persecuted at times, and were almost always at a disadvantage in competition with pagans. They believed firmly that virtue would be rewarded in heaven and sin punished in hell. Their sexual ethics had a strictness that was rare in antiquity. Pliny, whose official duty it was to persecute them, testifies to their high moral character. After the conversion of Constantine, there were, of course, time servers among Christians, but prominent ecclesiastics, with some exceptions, continued to be men of inflexible moral principles. I think Gibbon is right in attributing great importance to this high moral level as one of the causes of the spread of Christianity. Gibbon puts last the union and discipline of the Christian Republic. I think, from a political point of view, this was the most important of his five causes. In the modern world, we are accustomed to political organization.